Now we're going to have our first reading this evening, and Ken's going to do our readings tonight. And our first reading is Esther chapter 4.
When Mordecai learned of all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the city, wailing loudly and bitterly. But he went only as far as the king's gate, because no one clothed in sackcloth was allowed to enter it. In every province to which the edict and order of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping and wailing. Many lay in sackcloths and ashes. When Esther's maids and eunuchs came and told her about Mordecai, she was in great distress. She sent clothes for him to put on instead of his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther summoned Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs, assigned to attend her, and ordered him to find out what was troubling Mordecai and why. So Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate. Mordecai told him everything that had happened to him, including the exact amount of money Haman had promised to pay into the royal treasury for the destruction of the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the text of the edict for their annihilation, which had been published in Susa, to show that Esther and explain it to her. And he told him to urge her to go into the king's presence to beg for mercy and plead with him for her people. Hathach went back and reported to Esther what Mordecai had said. Then she instructed him to say to Mordecai, "All the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, that he be put to death. The only exception to this is for the king to extend the gold scepter to him and spare his life. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king." When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer: "Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. But that you have come to royal position for such a time as this." Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai: "Go gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for them. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." So Mordecai went away and carried out all of Esther's instructions.
So, we come on to sermon number one. Carrying on the Grievesian pattern, if I can call it that, this splits nicely into two sections, so we're going to do it in two parts. And so, the first is Mordecai under threat, mourning and mission. Now, I've got to be clever here because I've got to zip over here to get the next picture. But I won't do that just for a moment because I need to just remind you of the story so far. Okay? So, the story so far, chapter 1. Xerxes, the emperor, has held a 180-day feast. That's half a year. He held a feast for 180 days for all his top brass to show off to them his splendour, followed by a little 7-day feast for the locals in Susa. Queen Vashti was summoned, do you remember, to be put on display before all these top brass, and she refused, and consequently is deposed as queen. And a decree is sent out to all husbands in the empire to stand no disrespect from their wives. That went down well. In chapter 2, a beauty contest is held throughout the empire to find a successor to Vashti. And the winner is Hadassah, otherwise known as Esther, the orphaned cousin of Mordecai, her carer. Mordecai then successfully thwarts an assassination attempt on Xerxes' life. Chapter 3, Haman the Agagite, that's a descendant of the Amalekites, the deadly enemies of the Jews, is promoted to be prime minister. But Mordecai refuses to bow to him because it's against his religion. He won't bow to anyone except God. So he doesn't bow to a person. So Haman plots against Mordecai and the whole Jewish nation. And at the end of the last sermon, we discover that Xerxes agreed to a decree to kill all the Jews in the empire. That's Mordecai and everyone else. Genocide, basically. And they draw lots to find out the dates when this should take place. And coincidentally, it's the 12th month from then. So they got 12 months until this genocide should take place. So we're left with Mordecai and all the Jews hearing that this decree, which, remember, in Persia means for all time, you can't change a decree, they are going to be eradicated from the empire. We think that Xerxes was a man of very little brain. And in fact, history, in fact, underlines that. He wasn't a very intelligent person. And he probably thought that it was just a handful of people. He had no idea how big the Jewish nation was, you know, they're being carried away into his empire. So he's a bit sort of simple in that respect. So we're now on to chapter 4. And the news of this decree causes our friend, now see if I can do this correctly. Yeah. causes our friend Mordecai to be absolutely horrified that he and the whole nation are going to be the targets for Haman. So he's filled with grief and horror. And as a traditional sign of this, he puts on sackcloth and covers himself with ashes. This means that he can't any longer go and chat to Esther. You remember, he kept on popping in inside the palace gates and having a chat with her, but he can't do this anymore because you can't go through the palace gates wearing sackcloth and ashes, because that will remind the king that, you know, death and mourning takes place. And he doesn't want to have anything to do with that, so you have to stay outside. So poor old Esther doesn't know what's going on. She's in isolation in the king's harem, and she hasn't got a clue what's going on. But she gets news via her servants that Mordecai is wandering around wearing strange apparel, making strange noises, and is in the state. So what does she do? Well, verse 4 in the chapter tells us. She sends him a change of clothes. You know, don't wear sackcloth. Put this on, then you can come and chat to me. But he refuses. And so she sends her chief servant, Hathach, to find out why. Anyway, Mordecai then gives her a copy of the decree that the king has now sent out. And hopefully, there he is, giving a copy of the decree and saying to Hathach, go back to Esther, tell her what the king has done, and explain what that means. He then says, ask Esther if she will go to the king and beg for mercy. Well, Esther reminds Mordecai of the danger of going to see the king. Do you remember what it said? No one is allowed to go up to the king and ask to speak to him. It has to be from him. And if you do that, the chances are you will be put to death. The only thing that he can do to allow you not to die is to take his golden scepter and say, come on in, I'm willing to speak to you. And that's the only way that this will work. But she is taking a huge risk, especially as she hasn't been seeing him for a month. So Mordecai reminds her, look, Esther, the king may not know that you're a Jew, but don't think that just because you're the queen if this genocide takes place, you will be exempt from it, because you won't. Someone will point the finger at you, and you will die along with all the other Jews. Don't worry, though, he said. I'm sure God will somehow send someone or some do something to stop this from taking place. I trust in God that this will happen. But don't you think that it's possible that's why you're queen? You know this beauty contest. You know that you won. And you wondered why. Could this be the reason? That you are the woman in the right place at the right time. So he sows that seed in her mind. So what does Esther do? She organises a prayer meeting. Isn't that fantastic? 3 days she asks all the Jews throughout the empire to pray and to fast on her behalf. And with great courage, she agrees to do as Mordecai suggests. Whatever the cost, if I die, I die, she says. So, oops, I've just knocked the top off the microphone. Won't be a minute. There we are. So there she is, deep in thought. What is this going to mean for me? 2 things to learn from this little story so far. The first thing is that Mordecai sees behind all this that God has probably got a cunning plan. What about Esther? Well, she's got a lot to lose, hasn't she? She's got her status she might lose, and certainly her life she might lose. But the thing is, when we're in particular situations, do we take a step back and think, well, this is a dreadful situation, but I wonder whether God has actually got a cunning plan here that I may not yet be appreciative of? I'm sure he wouldn't do something like this in my life, just like that, just to make it difficult for me. I wonder what God has in mind. Do we ever take that step back and think about it and think, well, perhaps God has got his hand upon me in some particular way? The second thing is, this is a remarkable insight in the Old Testament times of putting things into God's hands, isn't it? She calls for prayer. How often is that our last resort, not our first resort? When something happens, we think, oh, I must do this. Oh, I have to do that. I must see so-and-so. Do this, do this, do the other. But no, perhaps the thing we need to do most of all is to step back and to offer it to God. Or to get our friends to pray for us. One of the most wonderful things about Hannah Bowden and her current situation fighting cancer is that she's opened up this blog and asked people to pray for her. And she mentions from day to day things that are going that need prayer. And she's incorporating us all in her struggle. That's wonderful, isn't it? And, you know, do we do that though? Do we think about giving it to God in prayer? It reminds me a little bit about that story of Peter. Do you remember in Acts of the Apostles when he's in prison? He's been thrown in prison. And so they get together as a church and they pray for him. Pray for his release. And what happens? Well, God's angel comes into the prison, takes his chains off, gets him clothed, gets him out into the street, shows him half the way home, then leaves him and says, get home on your own now. And he goes to the house, Mary's house in Mark's mother's house in Jerusalem. And he knocks on the gate outside. And the servant girl, Rhoda, is sent to the gate. And she says, who is it? Who is it? And he says, Peter, it's Peter. Can't be you, you're in prison. So she goes back and she says, well, it's someone who sounds like Peter at the gate. And everyone says, don't be so silly, we're praying for his release. Can't be him, he's in prison. For goodness sake, get your head together, girl. Anyway, eventually the knocking becomes louder and louder and they do go along en masse to the gate, open the gate, and who's there? It's not Peter's ghost, it's Peter. Because God has done what they were praying for. It reminds me a bit of that story. But sometimes we just don't think of praying, do we? But Esther is willing to obey Mordecai and to try God out and put this situation squarely into his hands. Well, that's something to learn, isn't it? Part one, over.
On the third day, Esther thought there were no royal robes, and stood in the inner court of the palace, in front of the king's hall. The king was sitting on his royal throne in the hall, facing the entrance. When he saw Queen Esther standing in the court, he was pleased with her, and held out to her the gold scepter that was in his hand. So Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. When the king asked, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom it will be given to you." "If it pleases the king," replied Esther, "let the king together with Haman come today to a banquet I have prepared for him." "Bring Haman at once," the king said, "so that we may do what Esther asks." So the king and Haman went to the banquet Esther had prepared. As they were drinking wine, the king again asked Esther, "Now, what is your petition? It will be given to you. And what is your request? Even up to half the kingdom it will be granted." Esther replied, "My petition and my request is this. If the king regards me with favour, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfil my request, let the king and Haman come tomorrow to the banquet I will prepare for them. Then I will answer the king's question." Haman went out that day happy and in high spirits, but when he saw Mordecai at the king's gate and observed that he neither rose nor showed fear in his presence, he was filled with rage against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, calling together his friends and Zeresh his wife. Haman boasted to them about his vast wealth, his many sons, and all the ways the king had honoured him, and how he had elevated him above the other nobles and officials. "And that's not all," Haman added. "I'm the only person Queen Esther invited to accompany the king to the banquet she gave, and she has invited me along with the king tomorrow. But all this gives me no satisfaction, as long as I see that Jew, Mordecai, sitting at the king's gate." His wife Zeresh, and all his friends said to him, "Have a gallows built, 75 feet high, and ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go with the king to the dinner and be happy." The suggestion delighted Haman, and he had the gallows built.
Part 2. On the third day, after praying and fasting, Esther puts on her royal robes. I expect she looked a treat. I expect she took a bit of time putting the makeup on, you know. Our 14-year-old granddaughter took at least half an hour every morning. But she needed to look her best because she knew that her life was at risk. As she approached the king's sort of throne, he could look out and see her coming. And something must have inspired him to say, "Come on, here's my scepter, just touch it." So, you know, the king actually allowed her to, allowed her to touch the scepter, and she was there. She was accepted. No death penalty. That's marvellous. That's an answer to prayer to start with, isn't it? And what did he do? He promised to help her. He said, "Tell me what you want. I'll give you up to half my kingdom." Probably a slight exaggeration. You know what men are like. But, you know, it could have been a Porsche, could have been a Ferrari, but half my kingdom, will that do you? And she didn't really need that, did she? She said, "What I'd like to do is invite you to a banquet, which I've prepared." See, she was already in advance. She'd already got her plan. We know that because the banquet was already prepared. And he says, "Well, what is it you want? Tell me what you want, what you really, really want." Isn't that the Spice Girls? Yeah, I thought that came from somewhere. Yeah, that's what the king says to her. And she says, "Well, I want you and Haman to to come and have this meal with me? Oh, okay, right. And why does she want to do that? Well, we don't know yet. So, Haman is absolutely delighted. Absolutely in a state of pure and utter bliss. Because not only has he been promoted recently to Prime Minister, he's been the only person invited along with the king to a banquet by the queen. What is that about? Well, he's on cloud nine as he walks out into the palace grounds. You can imagine him, you know, floating along. And he goes up to the palace gates and the town gates, and there are all these important nobles that he's been elevated above, and they will bow to him. Yeah! Except for one, Mordecai. And what does Mordecai do? He does nothing. He sits still and doesn't move. And you can imagine, you know, you can imagine the sheer utter anger rising up inside Haman. Disrespect! Oh, I'll get him, I'll get him! But he manages, because he's so happy, to control his anger. He doesn't let himself down in front of everyone. And he goes home. And there, his wife Zeresh comes to meet him, and his cronies, I don't know, I can't remember what my next picture is. Is it that one there? Yeah, oh, that was the banquet, right. That's him having his banquet with Esther and the king. And, oh, he says to his family, he says, and his friends, I'm so great. I hope you don't mind me saying this, he says, but, you know, recently promoted to Prime Minister, and today, guess what happened today? Invited to a meal, and who was there? Just the king and me. God, I'm just so great. Amazing. He said, and I've got all these children, and I'm so wealthy. Ah, wouldn't you love to be me? He says to them all. However, he says, I'm really annoyed. There's this one person who gets on my nerves every time he does it, every time he fakes, oh, puts me on the edge. He will not bow down to me, the greatest. Oh. His friend said, you ought to do something about that. You can do it. You've got the power. You're Prime Minister, for goodness sake. Have this gallows built. Well, now, what do you want to really do? Oh, I'd like to humiliate him publicly. Well, that would be quite a good thing, wouldn't it? Let's make the gallows a bit higher than usual. 75 feet. Oh, that's quite a long way up, isn't it? And do you know what? They're not actually gallows. You know what gallows are, don't you? That's where they hang someone from. That's not what they did. Oh, no, no, no. It was a nasty 75-foot pole with a sharpened point. You know what a pencil looks like when you put it in a nice electric pencil sharpener? Yeah? What they did was, they took the person, they held them above this spike and went like that. Not a pleasant way to die, but that's what Mordecai decided he was going to have happen to his enemy. And there he is. Look at the look on his face. He's going to go through with this. And so, here he is, wanting to have this banquet with the queen the next day, because he's got part two to go forward to. And he's got this fantastic plan that his friends have suggested to him. It's all set up. All he got to do tomorrow morning is have Mordecai killed on the gallows, and then he can go along to a banquet as happy as a lamb. What a wonderful bit of way of exacting revenge. So what can we learn from that? Good question. Well, the first thing is, the Jews, Mordecai in particular, were hated by this man Haman, weren't they? And we've got to expect that to be the case for Christians. The world is going to hate us. Jesus told us that. He said, it's happened to me, the world hates me, it's going to hate you as well. The world is in the control of the devil. The devil wants to bring us down. He's dedicated to destroying the church, as we've seen in our series in Revelation in the morning. And Jesus wants to remind us that, don't worry, I'm in control. He says, all the powers of hell will never conquer the church. Here on earth you may have many trials and sorrows, but take heart, because I have overcome the world, he says. So it's a reminder to us that although it seems though everyone might be against us, that is not going to be the outcome. Haman was a bitter enemy of the Jewish nation, hence his ruthless dedication. And in New Testament times, it's no different. And things are getting more difficult, aren't they, today? Have you not realised that? The pressures on us, the world to squeeze us into its mould, are really great. It's becoming worse and worse in this country, in Europe generally, and in some places in the world, it's beyond belief what happens. So that's the first thing. We've got to expect opposition. The second thing is that God often inspires people to act in a particular way to further his kingdom in a way that they can never imagine by themselves. So this banqueting setup that Esther has put into place has been inspired by God. Absolutely clear. It's not something she's just, I was going to say, cooked up herself. I don't mean the banquet. But, you know, she's been inspired to come up with this way of dealing with Haman and the problem facing her. We can think of, for example, Peter, when he had that vision on the roof in Joppa. Do you remember about all these unclean things coming down and God saying, don't call anything I've made unclean? And then the Gentile comes along, knocks on the door and says, will you come and speak at my house? And of course that was very, very un-Jewish. And Peter says, well, oh, I see what God's telling me now. Yeah, I'll come and speak. And that was the first time that Gentiles heard the gospel. And it's because of that that we've heard the gospel. Because the gospel was open to Gentiles, generally. What about Martin Luther? In the throes of, you know, the Catholic Church getting people to pay all sorts of money to try and relieve their sins of this, that and the other. And he felt that that's wrong. It's against Scripture. It's by faith that we believe in God and God has us as his children. And so he wrote his 95 theses and nailed them to the door of the chapel in the University of Wittenberg on October the 31st, 1517, to be precise. And that led to the Reformation. God inspired him to do something quite out of the ordinary. And so throughout history that's happened. You may be able to think of an example yourself in your own life. I can remember one day when I was church in Harold, when I used to go there in Harold, and I was driving home one Sunday evening, and completely untypically, I had this thought in my head which says, don't go home, you ought to go and visit so-and-so. And I sort of said, don't be silly. And then I drove there, and I found that I was needed in a particular situation to help in a way that God had provided for me to do. And, you know, that was just so untypical. And it was God who put that thought in my mind. And it happens to us all probably at some point in our lives on occasions that God, you know, turns us into a different way of behaving. So, there we are. Things we can learn from this. But we're left on a cliffhanger at the end of this chapter. The story couldn't have been written any better if it'd been for a top TV series. How will it pan out? What is Esther's plan exactly? How will the king react to it? Can the eternal decree be nullified? Will Mordecai survive? Or will he go to excruciating death on the spiked pole? And what of poor Esther? Will she survive? Will she remain as queen? Is it possible that God has got everything under control? Well, to find the answers to that, those questions, you'll just have to come back next Sunday to hear the next thrilling instalment, which, oh, I wish it was me, which Lydia will be bringing it to you. Lucky Lydia. All will be revealed next week. Yes. God is in control, or isn't he? Come along next week and find out.